This is a program we call Conversation. It's dedicated to the art of good talk. Clifton Fadiman, editor of the American Treasury, is our host. His guests tonight are Emily Kimbrough, author and lecturer, Bennett Cerf, publisher and columnist for This Week magazine, and Commander Edward Whitehead, president of Schweppes USA Limited. This program is being repeated at the request of our audience. As we turn up our microphones, our conversationalists are engaged in reminiscences of tales about Christmas. Clifton Fadiman is speaking.
Christmas has become a universal holiday throughout Christendom. Originally beginning as a religious one, it's been taken over, as it were, by people who may have different creeds. And every human being who celebrates Christmas seems to be able to get from it some special pleasure. Whether or not he celebrates it as a religious holiday or not. Do you think that's true, Bennett?
Yes, he gets, as you said, it brings out the nicest things in people. This Christmas spirit has become something that I wish we could spread it out a little bit longer and make it last a month, maybe, instead of just a day.
I like to be caught up in the whole Christmas excitement. I want to be part of the push of crowds. Of the holidays, the holiday crowds, the Christmas shoppers are the pleasantest in the world. Nobody shoves and pushes. People, utter and total strangers, turn to you and say, I wonder if you'd advise me. Now, I have an old Aunt Mary, and she lives, and you hear the whole story of Aunt Mary, and do you think she would like these gloves? And you enter into that with the greatest enthusiasm, and I think it's all perfectly delightful.
I think that that is a manifestation of one of the most... powerful, I'm sure that this is the most powerful aspect of Christmas, and that is the way it creeps up on you. I don't mean in terms of time, I mean in terms of this Christmas spirit. I know many hard realists and people who resist this at all costs. They say, I will not participate in this racket that it has become. Mm-hmm. But willy-nilly, come Christmas Eve or perhaps a few days before, you're swept up in the whole...
But do you think it's a kind of a mob psychology, Commander, or do you think it's anything more creditable to the human race than that?
Well, I hope and really believe that it's something more creditable to the human race. I think that this is just a manifestation of the real Christmas spirit that Dickens referred to in his Carol.
You know, I think the human race really has a kind of half-ashamed desire to be good. And doesn't know what to do about it. The opportunities for most of the year are somewhat limited, and we sort of furtively embrace Christmas as the one time of the year in which we can be good without being discredited for it. You know, it isn't shameful anymore.
You don't have to be a little too smart.
There's a wonderful story that is terribly well known and exemplifies the whole Christmas spirit. But do you remember way back at the turn of the century, a little girl named Virginia O'Hanlon, I think her name was, wrote into the Evening Sun, a now extinct newspaper, and asked the editor, is there a Santa Claus? And they ran an editorial in the Sun called, Yes, Virginia, There is a Santa Claus, which was such a wonderful little piece, exemplifying the whole spirit of Christmas, that it's republished every year, I guess, in hundreds of newspapers.
Oh, more than that, it's republished in every anthology, Bennett. I suppose that's been with Albert Hubbard's A Message to Garcia. Perhaps that's the most single... most often reprinted short piece ever written in this country.
Well, it's an inspiring piece because it does give the whole spirit of what really should stand behind Christmas.
Or perhaps it's that everybody is in favor of a lovely illusion. And that's what Santa Claus is.
I'm absolutely convinced that Christmas is a children's holiday.
How did it become that, do you think, Commander? Why should it have? I named the Nativity, of course, of the Savior. But that isn't perhaps quite enough to explain the enormous... a spread of the feeling all over the world that this belongs to the children.
I think the Nativity story, as you say, which so prominently concerns the child, is also the most freely comprehended and therefore probably the first Christian story that the child is told and becomes deeply embedded in the child's consciousness at a very early age. I'm now talking, of course, in the Christian community. Yeah. And regardless of what happens later on, and however hard-boiled they may become, and however neglectful of their duties in that direction, they retain, I think, a tremendous deep feeling for the reality of the Christmas story.
One of the other attractions of Christmas, not only that it gives us a chance, as it were, to be good, but it gives us a chance to... to feel comfortable and cozy. Christmas is a peculiarly indoor holiday.
That's true.
In your country, it's your countrymen that invented the phrase, a man's home is his castle. And Chesterton, who has written so well about Christmas, stresses that. He says that something like this. He says the character of Christmas lies in two things. First, on the terrestrial side, the note of comfort rather than the note of brightness. And on the spiritual side, Christian charity rather than Christian ecstasy. I think that's very true, that at Christmas time we like to draw in upon ourselves, to retreat, as it were, into the warmth almost of the primeval cave. Now, that must be true, particularly in England.
An extremely significant point, and I think that there is no man or woman as lonely as one who is not or excluded from one of these caves on Christmas night.
Yes.
But I would like once more to emphasize that my feeling that you cannot dissociate effectively Christmas from children, because I think that to attempt to simulate the Christmas party spirit in with adults only, which usually means just eating and drinking too much, is a betrayal of the whole spirit of the thing. I think that unless it is centered around children, unless children are there on this day of all days, it loses a great part of its meaning.
I think, actually, that adults coming together within that warmth that you were describing partake of the spirit within themselves. I think in terms of gathering around the piano and singing the Christmas carols,
yes,
of playing games that one wouldn't play at any other time of the year. I think sometimes the happiest time is after the children have gone to bed.
Amen.
There's something in that. You know, Christmas seems to be a time in which grown-ups can forget that they live in a competitive world.
Mm.
Commander, can you recall any particular Christmas that sticks fast in your memory as a very happy one or a very dramatic one?
I can recall many, and most of all Christmases of early childhood, but I think as more typical, perhaps not quite typical, but the most symbolic Christmas that I can remember spending is the one I enjoyed early in the war when I was home on leave and felt that consciousness of the joy of Christmas was heightened perhaps by the awareness that one might not perhaps see another, or
yes,
that one might not be home for another. And that was a Christmas I spent with friends, with my family, but taking them to friends in the north of England who have a very lovely house, which itself looks rather like a fairy castle in a beautiful setting, and with a large house party of guests who really did seem to get the most out of that day, not only the Christmas day itself, which was largely spent indoors, except for a foray out into the ice and snow to work up an appetite after lunch, otherwise one just can't go on eating and drinking. And then most of the rest of the day is spent in games, this what we call charades, you call the game, don't you? And other childish games of that kind, which can give such infinite pleasure, but only at Christmas for some extraordinary reason to us grown up. But the great sequel that sticks in my mind to make that the perfect Christmas, and to me it's a sequel to Christmas every one I spend in England anyway, is hunting on Boxing Day. Now, hunting to us is not, as to you, with a gun, but after a pack of hounds, either on foot or on horseback. And in that particular instance, the whole party turned out in cars and went about 20 miles north to the Lake District, where the mountains and the lakes of Wordsworth's Lakeland exist, and where the foxes hunted on foot with a pack of foxhounds. And you really do take the most strenuous exercise and enjoy it immensely after the somewhat overindulged days.
You
preceded.
Said Boxing Day, Commander.
Boxing
I don't
Day.
Think people listening here are going to know just what you mean by that. You said hunting on Boxing Day. What's Boxing Day?
Good Lord, I'd forgotten it was not.
No, we don't
just
have
as
Boxing
much a part
Day
of
here.
Your life.
No,
yeah,
we don't.
Boxing Day is as important as Christmas Day. To us, it's a bank holiday.
When is it?
It's the day after Christmas.
Well, that's a good Christmas to remember. Emily, have lived as a child in a very different part of the world from the commander here. And before we break up this evening, I want to hear from the great heart of the Middle West.
Oh, what Christmases those were at Muncie, and how I loved them. We all gathered at my grandmother and grandfather Kimbrough's house, and that included the aunts, the uncles, the cousins. And we each of us in our own house had our Christmas stockings early in the morning, and that was all. Then we gathered at the big house, and the library was closed off, and each member of the family, and there were some 17 of us, had a particular chair with a name tagged on, and all presents for that particular person were put around the chair. And then, at the moment, finally, when we thought would never come, we children, the doors were thrown open. My mother went to the piano, and she always played a favorite hymn of my grandfather's, good stirring old hymn, for he cometh to make up his jewels. The one particular Christmas that stands out in my mind, because it also was tinged with considerable anxiety for me, was the time in which my father gave my mother a very attractive, very beautiful ring. But before Christmas, there had been some additions made to our little house, and so my mother and father had agreed that they would not give each other Christmas presents of any moment, but that the additions to the house would be the mutual Christmas present. But my father didn't keep to his bargain, and he did buy this piece of jewelry for Mother. But he put on the Christmas card to her with love from John. And John was the trash man who came, was quite a well-known figure in the town, and about as disreputable a character as ever went down the streets of Muncie. And he had he drove an old, also decrepit, also disreputable-looking white horse. And all the rest of the family laughed heartily over this, that the trash man should have given Mother this ring. I was deeply disturbed. I was very much frightened about this because I'd always heard, always read in all the stories, that somebody came on a white horse and carried off the lady fair, and I therefore immediately assumed that John was a definite challenge to the sanctity of our little home.
You know, your story strikes a note with me because the particular Christmas I was describing just now is in a part of the world where large houses are still inhabited by people who can afford to live in them, which is there are very few such places, even left in Britain. And very close by, and in fact the home of my host before he was married, is a very famous house called Levens in the north of England, where just such a legend lives to this day. The ghost walks on Christmas night regularly, and nobody will ever deny having seen it, although I doubt whether many have, in fact. And it is as haunted as any place could be, but it seemed to have had the same effect removed.
How nice to be able to afford a Christmas ghost. So nice. Bernard, I don't want to deprive you of the chance of telling us about some favorite Christmas of yours, if you have one in mind.
Hey, let me take a second. I think it was a compatriot of Commander Whitehead's who once said that the giver is twice blessed. I really found out how wonderful Christmas is when our first little boy was born, Christopher. The first Christmas he was around had a savor for me that none of the ones that where I was the center of attraction ever had. This may sound corny, but I'm telling you the truth.
I haven't any of my own to recall, but I'd like to tell you about a Christmas that my wife told me about that she experienced. This is a very unusual one. She was in Manila in Christmas 1941 as a war correspondent. And at that date, you remember, the Japanese were just about to take Manila. And all our men were evacuating. The temperature was 90 degrees. It's, of course, midsummer there, just as you were saying. And no ships had come for a month, and no mail had arrived. And everybody was trying to figure out whether they should stay and brave the terrors of the Japanese or try to escape. They didn't know how the Japanese would act. If they were to escape, they had to paddle to Australia, and indeed many did. Or they'd have to hide out into the hills until our army would come to the rescue. Didn't know how long that would take. Well, in the main hotel in Manila, the correspondents and soldiers and so forth gathered around, and they, with this terrible fear hanging over them, and tried to create a Christmas with the Japanese imminent. And there are no evergreens, of course, in Manila. They used anything they could for decorations and gifts. They got made a feeble little imitation tree out of some palm strands, which they tied around a broomstick and gathered around it. And then they wrapped ping pong balls in the tin foil that you get from cigarette cartons, boxes, to make decorations. and they gave each other gifts such as a flashlight or some powdered milk, which was all they had. And they tried to joke, and they tried to make tried for comic presents, but wasn't much of a go. And there they stood, celebrating Christmas and singing Christmas carols at the same time, listening for the air raid alarm, which was imminent. That's the way my wife spent Christmas in 1941.
Gosh, oh, this is the kind of a story Alexander Wilcott could have stretched out to 358 pages.
Tell me, is Dickens's Christmas Carol still read as part of the tradition?
I think, actually, it's still the symbolic tale of Christmas, and it is read very widely in England.
I think that divisions between fathers and children have often occurred solely on Christmas Day owing to the passionate ambition of the father to read the whole Christmas carol to his children.
I think the happiest time is gathering around the piano, and also is one thing in which I stress about that, and that is get enough copies of the Christmas carol so that everybody has a copy. This business of everyone gathering around over only the two shoulders of the one at the piano and then sort of mumbling the words and not being able to see and not being able to follow
right
through is a miserable thing. But for
right
everybody to have the book of Christmas carols and to gather around is to me the happiest way of ending the day.
In this country, I've never spent the pre-Christmas period here in America as yet. I've just arrived, and I'm always in Britain or some other country where I love to be immediately before Christmas. We carols are most associated with us, with carol singing in other people's houses or outside other people's houses in the few days before Christmas. If you live in the country where I lived for a long period, even fairly recently, it is the habit of neighboring families, one or two fairly trustful spirits like mine and my family's, to get together a group and say, we'll dream up a charity that we happen to be fond of, and we'll have boxes with slots in the top, and we'll go around to everybody's house in the neighborhood, including the village pub, and sing outside until we're invited in and given a drink. That isn't the actual objective. We'll sing for carols for the sheer fun of it, whatever the weather, out of doors for the three or four nights preceding Christmas. And that, to my mind, will always be the proper way to sing yes carols, by the light of a lantern and perhaps no light at all.
Well, we do it here, Commander. I lived in East 61st Street, New York City, right in the middle of town. And the Third Avenue L thundered past very near our bedroom windows. You couldn't have been more centrally located, as the real estate people say, but heavens, you couldn't have been more citified. But just a day or two, night or two before Christmas, down 61st Street and up 62nd Street, came these citified neighbors whom we had never really met before, singing under our windows. And I thought it was so
loveliest
odd
thing that could be, I
yes
think.
Yes,
yeah, yeah. I'm delighted
yeah
to hear it goes on here in
yes
New York,
yes,
too.
Yes, we have it.
The only time we have it in London that I'm aware of, except for the great carol concert at the Albert Hall, which Malcolm Sargent always conducts, when we have the best choirs available to sing solo carols, and then a number of other carols which the whole audience stands up and roars for their heart's content. But the only other time that it's becoming an institution now in London again is the round the Christmas tree, which the Norwegians give London every year. It comes from the citizens of Oslo, and it is rigged up in Trafalgar Square amongst the fountains, and lit and decorated with tinsel and all the usual trappings. And round that tree every night gather strangers of all kinds and sing carols.
Well, you've seen our wonderful tree outside of Rockefeller Center here, haven't
yes
you?
Yes.
It's a wonderful thing, though, Bennett, to have that tree.
Oh, it's
once
wonderful
a year.
Wonderful. And I love the ones on Park
so
Avenue.
So do I. I love that string of Christmas trees up
well
Park
it shows
Avenue
you that Christmas isn't necessarily associated only with the countryside and
that is true
white snowy roads.
I think as with us Christmas is a very nostalgic time, and we all hark back to our own childhood, where I'm now talking of England, when Christmases always seem to be white, snow on the ground and frozen lakes to skate on and so on. But of late, we don't have that. I don't know why, but something seems to have happened to the weather. It's always
the
green.
Gulf Stream,
the Gulf Stream. I know. And it's now always warm and balmy, and it's awfully difficult to do as much justice to your plum pudding and turkey under those conditions. But we struggle on. But nevertheless, I still think that Christmas should be a country institution and a family institution. But if you're in a town, if you're in a city like New York or London, then you have to make the best of it with these.
Well, you can always go, Commander, to one of the big department stores where they do Christmas up in the toy department magnificently. I'm sure Emily's been shopping in them for her grandchildren. You see
so
Santa Claus, you hear the carols, you see all the newest decorations. They really do it up fine. There's a story about one of these department store Santa Clauses. He was a great actor in his day, great star. And he had gotten down to the point where the best job he could get was being the department store Santa Claus. And he sat in his chair saying hello to all the children, feeling very sorry for himself at the same time. One little boy was quite a lot nicer than the rest. He was attracted to the little boy, and he was very nice to him. The little boy told him what he wanted. And then the little boy said, "Wouldn't you like to meet my mother?" And Santa Claus said, "Yes, I would." And Mother came forward, and Santa Claus's heart went down to the bottom of his shoes because the very well-dressed woman who came forward was his former wife. She had been his wife when he was a great star. And he hoped that the foliage he was wearing, whiskers, something like the commander's here, would conceal his identity. She gave no sign of recognition. And the little boy said, "Mommy, give Santa Claus your address so that he can send all these presents, the spaceship and everything else that I've ordered." So she obligingly wrote down an address on a piece of paper and put it in a little envelope and handed it to Santa Claus and took the little boy away. And he breathed a sigh of relief that she hadn't recognized him. And he opened the envelope a little bit later. And what was written inside was, "Merry Christmas to the greatest actor I have ever known." And pinned to it was a check for $1,000.
Well,
that's
story,
a nice Christmas
story.
Oh,
that's
absolutely lovely.
One Santa Claus story that is true and not quite so sweet and touching as that one? This was a time when my twin daughters were very small. They must have been about 3, I think. And they had overheard me saying vehemently, "I am going to get a rocking chair. I want a rocking chair in the nursery. I don't care what psychiatrists say about rocking your children. I want to be able to rock my children, tell them stories and so forth, and I haven't a rocking chair to my name." Well, that was, I don't know at what time during the year, sometime during the fall, at any rate, during the Christmas season, when Santa Claus appeared at the department store in the neighboring village. We lived then outside Philadelphia. I one morning thought, "I will take the twins to see the Santa Claus. We will do it in the morning. There won't be very many people, and I think they might be rather excited and pleased about it." So I snatched them up from their play, and they looked rather disreputable, having been out in the play yard a great part of the morning. And I swept them off to the village, and we went up. But I found that there were quite a number of people. However, I persevered, and we got into the line. We came up to the Santa Claus. Santa Claus put an arm around each of the twins, and he said, "And what would you like for Christmas?" And one of the twins, and the other echoed, spoke out in a voice loud and clear and said, "A chair for my mommy, because she hasn't a chair to her name." And I thought perhaps the big brothers would come around with a Christmas basket.
Can I take up a point that Emily's referred to twice, once in connection with the rocking chair and earlier in connection with another present in the family? In England, I'm not quite sure whether this is universal in my country, but it's certainly so in my family now and in my own family when I was a child. You could never give a useful present. If you gave something to your mother, father, sister, brother, wife, child, anything that was necessary, something that they needed about the house, such as giving your wife a chair or a toast rack or even a washing machine. I knew there was. Is it true also in this country, as Carolyn Wells said, that "I love the Christmas tide, and yet I notice this each year I live. I always like the gifts I get, but how I love the gifts I give."
But now that you've mentioned Carolyn Wells, I have a bit of poetry, too, that I brought along.
Good.
I may as well tell you that we're not going to read from the Christmas carol, Commander Emily. But speaking of gifts, I'd love to read a line or two from Mr. Ogden Nash, which is
my
quite appropriate. This is beautifully titled. He calls it, "I'm a Pleasure to Shop For." Says, "Mine is a dauntless spirit, meaning a spirit that is hard to daunt.
Therefore, since nobody gives me Christmas presents anymore, I shall console myself by compiling a list of Christmas presents that I do not want. I do not want a lamp made out of an umbrella stand, or a coffee table made out of an old wagon wheel, or a fire screen made out of a leftover piece of trellis, or indeed anything made out of or to look like anything else.
Notice you had something there that you had marked for possible reading, Commander. Could that be so?
It was one of my favorite lines from Charles Kingsley, which does more to point up what I think is the true spirit of Christmas. The heath eats up green grass and delicate flowers. The pine eats up the heath, the grub the pine. The finch the grub, the hawk the silly finch. And man, the mightiest of all beasts of prey, eats what he lists. The strong eat up the weak. The many eat the few, great nations small. And he who cometh in the name of all, he, greediest, triumphs by the greed of all. And armed by his own victims, eats up all. While ever out of the eternal heavens, looks patient down the great magnanimous God, who, maker of all worlds, did sacrifice all to himself, nay, but himself to one, who taught mankind on that first Christmas day what 'twas to be a man, to give, not take, to serve, not rule, to nourish, not devour, to help, not crush, if need, to die, not live. O blessed day, thou givest the eternal lie to self and sense and all the brute within. O come to us amid this war of life, to hall and hovel, come to all who toil in senate, shop, or study, and to those who, sundered by the wastes of half a world, ill-warned and sorely tempted, ever face nature's brute powers, and men unmanned to brutes. Come to them, blessed and blessing, Christmas Day. Tell them once more the tale of Bethlehem, the kneeling shepherds, and the babe divine, and keep them men indeed, fair Christmas Day.
Lovely lines. I like particularly that phrase, to give the lie to self. Oh, almost time to break up, isn't it, Emily?
I'm afraid so.
One other little rhyme I remember that seems very appropriate and jolly to end this session with. It's an old beggar's rhyme, again from your country, Commander. Christmas is coming, the geese are getting fat. Please to put a penny in the old man's hat. If you haven't got a penny, a halfpenny will do. If you haven't got a halfpenny, God bless you. Merry Christmas, Emily.
Merry Christmas, and God bless us, everyone.
Happy New Year.
You've been listening to Conversation, a series of programs dedicated to the art of good talk. Our host was Clifton Fadiman, author of Party of One. His guests tonight were Commander Edward Whitehead, president of Schweppes USA Limited, Miss Emily Kimbrough, author of the new book Water, Water Everywhere, and Bennett Cerf, publisher of Random House and Landmark Books. Next week at this same time, Clifton Fadiman will have as his guests J.B.